All right, we're live. All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm here with Gabe Jones from Deposit Cloud, powered by Resident Radius. And Gabe, I've been chatting I've been chatting back and forth with this company since going back to Blueprint last year when I connected with a bunch of your team members at Blueprint, and then again at OpTech, and then just throughout. And really love your team. You guys are doing a great job at the market. I'm excited for everyone listening today to hear about the business and the business that you're in. I love it. I wish I invented it and did it. What you guys are doing is so brilliant. And I'm thrilled by when I meet people that are solving such a great problem, a great way. And then when you get the boost of compliance as tailwinds, I'm just like celebrating your success and what you guys are out there. So I'm super pumped for you guys. I'm thrilled about this conversation today. For everyone listening, Getting to Hell Yes is a conversation around the buyer's needs and the problems that they are seeking to solve. And the big difference between kind of a conventional sales model and a Hell Yes model is that the buyers actively acknowledge that they are seeking a problem to solve. And this is where I think there could be some things for us to dig in on a little bit, because the conventional approach to doing this maybe illegal, maybe not even know they're doing it the right way, but it exists. And so talking about the alternatives that are out there to solve the problems, what they type into Google, any objections you guys get when you're out there talking to people about the solutions that are out there, those are really interesting to dig in on. And ultimately learning about why your buyer chooses to make a decision, when your buyer chooses to make a decision and what that timing feels like. It's fascinating because every single buyer goes through their own journey, and as sellers, those that are having the most success in the market, tech might call it product market fit, are the ones that are there to solve a problem that the buyer is aware of versus when we're sellers and we're trying to get them to convince them of a new way. This is brought to you by IRCX. We are AI powered remote maintenance software. We help you solve problems before you roll. Basically, we solve blind triage, blind dispatch, blind spend on your maintenance side of things, and know before you roll is kind of what we talk about. Everybody that's listening, you're welcome to offer questions. It makes it much more dynamic, and hey, it's fun to watch us bump us off of our wrap while we're going at it. As we always kick things off, after my first little opening, as we pass it off to the guest, and Gabe, I'm thrilled to hear more about your background. How did you get in this role, and what's the problem that Deposit Cloud solves?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me as a guest. I am super excited, super excited. Actually, when I met you at AIM not long ago, right, earlier this month, I wish we could have spent a little bit more time together, but oh my goodness, you are so warm and friendly. You're such a good human. I love it. Oh, so
there you go. Oh, my kids.
I just want to start with that, because I thought, oh, I wish you're the type of person that it's like, oh, I wish I spent a little bit more time with you. But hopefully at Apartmentalize, we can spend a little bit more time. But also listening to some of your other guests and stuff, you've had some really great guests. This is this is a really a great podcast for anyone that is entering into our industry and is new. They need to listen to your podcast. I mean, there's like quite a few great podcasts, but I think this is a really good one for anybody entry level. You will get such a depth of knowledge, because some of your guests, some of us have been around for a long, long time in the industry for over 20 years, but you can just get a lot of good info. But kind of going back to the question asked.
Thank you. Yeah, so about you.
Yeah. So, but I know you're the firstborn, so you do like to hear about yourself, right? No, just kidding.
I'm a narcissist. I'm a born narcissist. I have to defend against it.
So hilarious. Hard to tell. But anyway, so I go by Gabe. My name is Gabriella. I also, when I'm posting, you'll see the hashtag of Gabe on the go, because A lot of times people will think that I'm all over the place, but it's really that I'm capturing memories and adding them into any of my posts or whatever. So they think I'm everywhere. But I grew up in Orange County. I'm one of three daughters and a son of immigrant parents that insisted we speak Spanish at home and that we learn English at school. So that's kind of the way that I grew up. Also, I was taking French for a number of years. So I always say I'm trilingual because I'm always trying to speak French, but I don't remember most of it because I don't use it. So I just remember a few words here and there. But
we have the same upbringing. Exactly the same upbringing. So immigrant folks.
Well, kind of. You grew up going to school speaking French though. So I'm sure your French is
it's touch and go. When it gets rolling, it gets rolling really well, but definitely my mom spoke English, my dad spoke Spanish, and I was educated in French, and of course my buddy spoke English. And so I say I was loved in English, I was punished in Spanish, and educated in French.
Right, in French. Well, my French, just to give you an idea, when I was in France, I remember asking for extra ice and it ended up with ice cream. So, you know, there's those little things that don't work so well. but really because of my home, it really instilled a strong work ethic. And for my parents, it was like, learn the language and work hard and you'll always be successful. That was kind of their motto. So I kind of feel that led us to a really good track of all of us kids working really hard. So this year I have 14, I'll be married 14 years with my wonderful husband named Chris. And I have two bonus kids. I have Caleb and Chelsea, a daughter and a son. With Caleb, he was 5 years old. So I've been a bonus mom for him since he was 5 years old, and he's graduating this year, or actually this week. What should I say? This week. So this week he graduated from high school. So that's kind of a big milestone in our household that's kept us a little bit busy. Also, my journey into multifamily, how did I get here? So there's actually a couple of different chapters with multifamily because, my first sales job was really through some company said I could make a lot of money. I started working for this commission only sales type of job, which I had no idea that there was jobs that actually gave you a salary plus commission, but I went in full board with commission only. And that was super great because I grew really fast within that company. I was promoted, was doing really great until I wasn't because the company ended up going bankrupt. And I found out about a week after my honeymoon, I'd gotten married, and a week after I was left with a lot of debt because of business expenses. I was doing a lot of things for them, but I thought, forget sales. I'm never doing that again. That was such a horrible experience. Something stable. So I found a job as a leasing agent. So that's what really introduced me to multifamily. So as a leasing agent, I interviewed, got the job. It was a beautiful new lease up in a really bad neighborhood. So that was a little bit short-lived because I really felt unsafe in touring prospects.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that was, so then I left and I ended up ultimately working at a brokerage firm and Payne Weber, loved it. I thought I was gonna be there forever, but then my sister was working at a boutique property management company and there was a marketing position. She said, oh my gosh, this is a great company. You should really think about going into marketing. I applied not thinking I'd really get it because I didn't have the experience and because I really didn't need the job. I was asking for, you know, whatever more I was making, 5 weeks of vacation, paid vacation immediately. I thought they'll never say yes. And they said yes. So that's my second iteration of multifamily going back into it. And it was great. It was fantastic working for this company. later on, I was recruited by a rep, Mark Lacey, who's still in our industry, to go work for ForRent. So then I ended up back on the sales side, and I was scared to death. And I think a part of it, I still had PTSD from my initial sales job that I had. But this time it was definitely a lot more stable. It was super exciting because I was in the role of being on the other side, working on the operator side, and kind of understand what the pain point. I fell in love with it. I doubled what my income was. And this was during a time that now I was divorced. I was helping my mom. She was really sick. So it really kind of just changed the way that my life was going. It was really super positive. And then as time went on, I ended up working with startups. And that's where I really found that it was super exciting. It was super exciting. That's kind of where I thrived. Just an example, I know it's a long answer to your one question so far, but I ended up working for Checkpoint ID, which was what, you know, a startup. Brian Antrim is the one that started, the founder of it. And I found that because I could relate, you know, Checkpoint ID was a fraud prevention, right? And it was also, it initially started as a safety tool for leasing agents to make sure that you would check somebody's ID before touring. So that fact, because of me having my first multifamily job as a leasing agent, that totally spoke to me. So I could get behind it, be passionate. It was super fun to grow that company, and then eventually it sold, right? So then here comes the exciting part. That's how I ended up later with Deposit Cloud, because the company Checkpoint ID sold. I was looking for a new home with a new startup, and it was perfect timing. Michael Bowman, the CEO and founder, we started chatting. He told me what he was doing, and I just thought, why haven't you hired me? Like, this is great. I love it. I love what you're doing. So that's kind of how I ended up on this side for Deposit Cloud.
And so what's exciting about the Deposit Cloud side of things, and we still haven't revealed the problem yet, is that how did you get interested in the problem that Deposit Cloud solves?
Well, first of all, having worked within multifamily, right? And actually even working prior to on the operation side, there is so much difficulty. There are so many processes. There are so many risk and around some of the things that are done on site and even on corporate level, right? I found that out with Checkpoint ID also, because there was a lot of, we had to be really careful. There was a lot of compliance around what we were doing. But even more so with security deposit, and this is on the cash management side, right? So security deposits are, a resident, a prospect comes in, they're told this is what your security deposit is. Sometimes it's really low. Sometimes it's a little bit higher. I'm in California. So California, Washington, Oregon, there's a lot of legislation around it, right? In Florida,
maybe
Chicago.
2801.
What's that?
Maybe 2801.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe 2801. So the first iteration, for example, good job.
Yeah, I know my laws.
You do. Yeah. So, you know, April 1st, for example, California here. AB 2801 here in California, it started April 1st. The second iteration of that is
July 1st. Nobody is prepared. Nobody is prepared.
Yeah, the ones that are prepared weren't that prepared. And even because they say they're prepared, and then they'll admit, like, we're kind of prepared, right?
Well, I don't even know if because it hasn't been litigated yet. Like, I don't know. I mean, there's a litigation that happened, like, I think it was 2 years ago. Somebody got burned, a manager got burned for $1.5 million in fines for a deposit, kind of like shady stuff. But I don't think AB 281 has been litigated yet, so the compliance piece of it has yet to have any teeth. But it's out there. I mean, it's more so than anybody else, right? And I know folks in Florida are concerned because they're seeing similar legislation be proposed for the same reasons. So
Yeah, in some of these legislation, you know, that go through, they're so ambiguous that it's easy for somebody to go and sue companies. That's the scary part. Even in Florida, right? It's like you have these ambulance chasing attorneys that hone in on something specific, and now they're sending letters to residents. Hey, we'll go ahead and help you sue the company. We're going to get you three times the amount of whatever your deposit was, and plus legal fees along with that, you know? So it's hard sometimes for obviously ownership to just even comply. They think they're complying, mm-hmm. but they find out they're not. So even on the operation side, right, they could be complying, but if your on-site team maybe isn't educated as well, and, you know, especially the on-site team that has like a revolving door, it just becomes really difficult to manage. That's why Deposit Cloud, knowing that this has been such a mess really with security deposits, this is why the cool thing is that the CEO and founder, I don't know if you had a chance to talk to Michael, but you should
briefly at TAA.
You'll have to really talk to him and get to know him. Yeah. He is awesome. He's got great background. He's got a great story. But anyway, he was working at Pinnacle in the past. So he comes from the operations side also. And so he saw all of this. He managed security deposit, alternative deposits. That's why he brought this solution to market, because he knew that there was a need. And this is what he created since 2017. So we're not super new, but I think the enhancements and the education part of it, because, you know, our industry isn't always quick to adopt to new technology or new thoughts, new processes. So it kind of does take a while to do that, as you know.
And for everyone listening, like AB2801 is a way of managing the deposit management on an exiting resident. Deposit legislation has been around forever. And so I just want to make sure we don't lead people down the road thinking that this is all because of AB2801, but deposit legislation has been around forever and it's getting trickier. So why don't we talk about that for a bit? So how is deposit legislation, so maybe framing the highest level, what are the legal obligations of a, and actually two questions, who has a legal obligation, the manager or the owner? And then how is it managed? What are the legal obligations of the person who is the custodian of that deposit during the tenancy?
Well, it's typically the operator, right? So mm-hmm. typically if the ownership, if they have a third party property management company, right, that's overseen, they're going to be the ones that are going to be liable. Although the ownership could also be sued also if it's not being managed well, right? Because ultimately it is their property. So there is a lot of liability. You talked about, and I don't know exactly which lawsuit you were talking about, the 1.5 million. Mm-hmm. If it's the one that I'm thinking, and I won't say names, but there's one in Orange County specifically.
Orange County. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's several. There's actually quite a few. There's quite a few lawsuits going on right now.
Well, the ambulance chasing is really easy. It's such an easy one to trigger. And given that most ownership groups don't have because you've got to prove that you're trying, right? Like the onus of proof for these kinds of lawsuits is typically that you actually put in the processes to prevent, you need to prove that you're preventing it from happening. And they're unable to prove that there's no signed off training documentation. There's no pre-existing process. There's loose documentation. And so it looks as though it's Keystone Cops from a legislation, from a litigation perspective. And at which point you're trusted with other people's money, which theoretically could be in an escrow, you are 100% culpable for not even trying. And that's where people are falling down.
Yeah. And you have so many people that are involved in that, right? So there's a particular friend in the industry that is the director or whatever of his company. Mm-hmm. And they're in a lawsuit right now. And they've had to go back years to prove what they were doing. And you hit it on the nail. The documentation just isn't there for them. So it's not looking really great for them. And it becomes difficult, especially as companies continue to try and have processes so that they do have documentation. But a lot of times now you're going back years, and what documentation did you have? Most of those, whether it's a leasing agent or it's the manager, they're gone. They're not even there. So it becomes really difficult, and it's very, very costly. That's why a company like Deposit Cloud, this is when you get the best of the best. This is all we do. This is our core product, Deposit Cloud, is that we're managing the security deposit. We're taking that risk away from the owners, operators, and also making it a good experience for residents. Not too many products have all of that. So, and I can go into, for the resident, it's giving him an option, right? So even for example, I think you have some friends in the that work in the alternative deposit sector, right? And so, and we have some partnerships too. We will work with any alternative deposits. We're agnostic. At the same time, we do have some partnerships with LeaseLock and guarantors also. But let's just say that, you know, the resident comes in, California, right? There's in each state also has specific laws around how much you can charge for deposits as well, right? So California, one times the rent is what you can charge. Now, a lot of times what happens is that the operator will go ahead and have such low security deposits. You know, the renting special is $200, moves you in. But what is the actual move out cost when they leave? Average is going to be, you know, in California, probably about $1,000. So now you're chasing that money at the end. You're leaving a really bad taste for the resident, because it's like, wait, I paid $200. Yeah, but your move out costs are, you know, $800 more. And now you're chasing it. This is where bad debt continues to go up. Our solution is to get a higher deposit, make it easier still for the resident to move in by creating an installment plan for them. They can go ahead, and it's up to each operator how they want to go ahead and do it. But typically, say it's 4 months, 6 months of a payment, they can go ahead and hit 50% and then make payments on the rest of it. And therefore, when they're moving out, they actually do have money that is going to be returned. We go ahead and say, hey, how do you want to go ahead and pay? You want to pay the full amount? That's fine. You want to do Venmo, Google Pay, Apple Pay? How do you want to do it? Do you want to go ahead and make installment plans? We can go ahead and set it up that way too. You're moving out, we're going to go ahead and give you your refund within 2 hours. You know, you want a digital Venmo, Google Pay? We're going to do it all those same ways. So we're making it for the resident a good experience. For the operator, again, it's mitigating that risk and compliance. We're taking that on, and they don't have to worry. You don't have to worry about somebody not being there, a manager not doing what they were supposed to do, because we're going to go ahead and handle the compliance side of it and make the resident happy also.
One thing we've been hearing a lot about is you know, it's too bad it's in the bigger problem, is when you got multi-year renters, right? So that the value of that deposit erodes relative to the duration of the tenancy. And so like the probability for a damage, you know, for that deposit being returned at 100% begins to kind of like go down as you have a longer tenancy, just because things get broken and there's wear and tear. And so like, what have you heard of people trying to solve that problem? Like if you're a 10-year renter, your rental deposit's worth nothing. If you midnight move and the place is a disaster, you can go chase a renter all day long. That's, you're just like, you're wasting the oxygen on the planet by doing that. So what are the alternatives there in that situation? I know that's a bit off tangent, off topic, but we'll get back.
Yeah, well, typically they would, what I understand is that they'll go ahead and do renewals every year, right? So if their deposit was so low, then they can still ask for another deposit. So
can they ask for another deposit year over year? So if like you're in California, can you ask for a deposit?
That's what some of our clients do. So
it's gotta be, but in an age of concessions on renewals, that must be exceptionally fine.
But, But you also have to be really careful, right? Because if somebody has been there, say 10 years, you really can't charge them. I mean, they're still, you have to look at, again, like you mentioned, wear and tear, right? So you also have to look at the wear and tear. What was it like when they first moved in? Let's say something broke, but that's different. If they damaged it or whatever, but there's normal wear and tear that you, that is expected that they can't charge for either. So
there's rental. I mean, I guess the kind of narrative around this last 90 seconds here is that it is complicated. It is subjective. It is other people's money. And we are trying to keep people in buildings and lease them up. And so like those things, and then it is governed and it has governance and compliance on it. So those things make it very difficult to manage at a site level staff turnover ratio around 50% when it's other people's money. So like let's dig in a little bit around that for Deposit Cloud, because like if you're operating in multiple jurisdictions, if you're operating in four different states, which isn't, it's pretty common, you have four different laws about how to manage other people's money.
Yes.
And that may not be the skill set of I would even go as far as your controller and your CFO. You don't want them doing that sort of stuff. And so who does it? Who does it today, typically?
Well, and you know what? You bring up a really good point because, so especially with companies that, you know, operators that are, that work in different states and in different jurisdictions, because even in California, like there, we also have different counties that have different security deposit laws. So you have to be careful, interest bearing and things like that. So we're managing all that. But we were talking to a director from a different state, and a law had changed around security deposits. So the law had probably been in effect for a couple months now. So when we're talking to this person, of course, I'm not going to out anybody or even say the state, because they were like, what are you talking? We said, oh, how are you guys dealing with this new law? And if I say the law, then you'll know what state, and it might be too easy to find out who they are. But they said, what law? And so when we're talking to them, we said, this law in the state that just happened like 2 months ago. They're like, I'm not aware of it. And I thought, holy crap, if you're not aware of it, is your team aware of it? Like, who's managing that? So,
well, in these laws, to make it even worse, when they become into effect, you need to start changing things 90 days before it became into effect. So everyone who's AB 281 is an example, April 1, you need to start changing your rental exit period 90 days before that. So like January 1, right? So it's, I mean, it's like you're already behind when you find out about it. You're so far behind, you know?
Yeah, they were probably just getting ready for, they probably were just finishing up from the law last year, July 1st. Yeah. So that will continue to change. And so that's all we do, is that we're looking at what laws are coming into effect. Chicago, same thing, right? They just had another new law. Some of the laws are really just putting the accountability, of course, on the operator to make sure that they're so tenant friendly that they forget the owners also like need time. They need to be able to sit at the table and tell them what works. But really it's, I understand. I mean, I was a renter for many, many years, for most of my life, until the last few years, but I totally get that. But I've always appreciated, I've always wondered, like, I can't believe that the owners have very little to say. It seems like in some of these states that it's really just all about the renter, and it's not, there's a lot of great renters. I was a great renter, but not all of them are. And they really take advantage
I take the position that it is other people's money and it is a deposit. You're not exchanging it for services, right? Like it's not a pre-down payment on wear and tear and things that might go wrong. It's a deposit. And so like in all cases, the deposit is an escrow piece. It's someone else's money. So if I go back to like the definition of custodianship or possession is 9/10, like the problem is that you're holding someone else's money on a probability that something that it's going to be recoverable, but there'll be damages recoverable. Because the existence of the deposit is to protect the landlord, the management of the deposit is to protect the resident. And so that's the part that I kind of like, I have a bit of empathy for the resident side of things, given that they are, it's other people's money and you're not exchanging that for anything on the day you sign that lease. So let's talk a bit about who does it today? When you talk to a prospect, who's the person that's managing deposits today at a property management, et cetera?
Yeah.
Is it a property manager or is it a?
It depends on the company. Typically it is going into, you know, it's through corporate. Obviously the property itself is managing that part of it, but then it's going into corporate, right? So they're the ones, the custodian, that are setting up however the accounts that they're doing it, whether they're putting it all in one bucket or they're not, because depending on the laws also, they can use that money for operations depending on the state and what the laws are, but they can actually use that money they just have to be sure that when that person moves out, that there is that those funds to be able to refund if there is a refund to be given. Right. So it just depends on the way that it's set up, but typically it's on the corporate accounting side that is holding the funds. They're managing.
And so that are managing the funds. So the people corporate are doing it today. So they typically are buyers today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And we're solving the problem on deposit management. So how big is the deposit management problem? So we talked about multi-jurisdiction, but in terms of like, just to give people an idea, we don't talk about this every single day. How big is the problem that people need to manage?
Massive. It is massive. It is really, really huge. And as you start to talk to, so it's kind of interesting because the buyer for what we do, it's kind of all over the board. Again, it just depends on the company. It could be, we may talk to somebody in marketing that is very engaged in putting out what's the best for the resident. And this is a great option because it gives a resident a good experience. But really, it's the operations, right? If we can get to a CFO that really understands, if we can get to the chief accounting officer, right? So they completely understand that. A lot of times on the operations side, it could be a director. We are selling to regionals and above, right? Executives, because even the regionals that work with specific, especially a third party, if they're working with specific portfolios, they're like, this is exactly what they're looking for, what my asset manager is looking for. I'm going to get in front of our asset manager. So a lot of times we're also going right to the ownership. That way we get the buy-in a lot quicker. It's easier for us to be able to provide the information accurately instead of kind of getting second party and only getting like a few highlights. So that's kind of the buyer. It's a little bit different for different operators, but we really do touch so many divisions and departments within the operator or even on the ownership side.
What's it like when you transition an account from a pre-existing deposit framework onto Deposit Cloud? So I can kind of imagine it pretty simply when someone's signing the very first lease, but I mean, you guys win deals with, there's already pre-existing deposits out there. How does that transition happen?
Great question. It's super easy. So when we roll out, when we start with a community, so we roll out new leases first, right? So we kind of get them all geared up for that. And then we kind of go back to the existing resident and we'll go ahead and manage it. We send them a marketing piece that says, hey, guess what? Whatever company is no longer managing your deposits, they're using Deposit Cloud, and here's all the benefits to you. Why we decided to use Deposit Cloud. It's going to be a faster process. It's going to be, you know, we just give them a good marketing piece to let them know all the benefits that will include their on their move out. So we can go ahead and actually transition all the current residents, previous residents they had, into Deposit Cloud. So that part of it, that piece is super easy to do.
And does a resident have a right to opt in or opt out?
Yes, they have the right to opt out. Yep. They automatically get opted in, and then they have the option to opt out.
And if they opt out, what is it? What happens to that, those funds?
Then the funds will continue to stay with the property management. The way we don't touch it, that just stays there until they transition out, and then eventually we have 100% of opt-in.
So what prompts your buyers to make change? Like what is happening in their lives that convinces them that, you know, I am just absolutely done dealing with this our internal people. This is low value work for our people. What creates them to say, we better make a change?
There's a few things. So for some of them, it's all the great options that they have with us, making easier for residents, but it's really saving them millions of dollars. It's saving them millions of dollars of bad debt, because when your deposits are so low, we look at your last 6 months and say, hey, these are your move out costs. Why do you have such low deposits? Let's get them up without hurting your leasing numbers or anything like that. This could actually increase it, because now you're giving a resident an option to make payments. When you raise that bar, you have better residents that have skin in the game because they have a higher deposit in there. So it really saves them millions in bad debt. It also is freeing up their teams to be able to focus on all the other millions of things that they have to do, not have to make that mistake of like, oh shoot, I didn't do this right. Oh no, I didn't file in 21 days. Oh no, I didn't. If they're using an alternative deposit, we will, again, work alongside with them. A lot of times they have to file, right? They, with an alternative deposit, whoever they're using, there's a filing timeframe that they have to do it in. A lot of times they forget to do that. We'll go ahead and signal them and flag them. Hey, by the way, you're using this, whoever you're using, you have 10 days to file. Nobody's paying attention. 5 days later, we're like, hey, by the way, we noticed you haven't filed anything. Make sure you're doing it. And then we'll escalate it to corporate on that. So it's a win-win.
So this is capital contingency management, in addition to deposit management, right? It's not just the liability, but it's also protecting. You talk about bad debt, and that might not necessarily immediately jump to mind when you think about deposit cloud or deposit management. Because and for everyone listening, correct me if I get this wrong, I'm just trying to play back so I understand. Is that you've got your liability, which is the asset that you're, which is liability is the rental deposit you've got on your books with someone else's money. And then you've got the expenses that you incur on move out. And in the best case scenario, you actually don't have to draw on the liability, but typically you do. And you incur an expense. And that expense, if it's uncollectible, becomes bad debt. And so let's say the expense exceeds the deposit. So you've got $1,000 deposit, $2,000 expense on move out for refurb. And then you're going to you'll take the $1,000 off the liability, put that against the expense. That'll offset $1,000, another $1,000 of expense instead of bad debt. And if it's uncollectible after 180 days, it moves into bad debt and becomes rent. And so that bad debt is cash out the door of the manager, then the owner. The manager might carry it for 180 days, then pass it back to the owner. And those are difficult conversations to have. And then, and it's undercover, essentially. And so if we can increase the contingency of the capital, the forecast for those expenses, then we can offset the probability of having to write off that. Is that the accounting?
Yeah, you're right on.
Cool. Okay, so why we're trying to avoid expense. So bad debt is the ultimate worst case scenario. But what the deposit cloud's doing is mitigating it before the resident exit, so we can kind of a forecast of what that might look like. This is much more sophisticated than I originally understood.
Yeah. The other reason too that on the accounting side, why they love us is because they never have to send another check out again, because we're managing all that. Other part of it is sheetment. That's a whole nother thing that accounting is, we haven't talked to a whole lot of companies that really have that down, because escheatment has been such an issue, especially for companies that are.
And what's escheatment?
Escheatment is unclaimed funds. So when you send out when the manager or the accounting team sends out a check and then it comes back because they have an old address. So by law, so you have to continue looking for that resident, that ex-resident that's moved out, and make sure that they're getting their money. But a lot of times that doesn't happen because they're too busy. And after 2 years by state government, you have to make sure that you're letting them know, like, here's all the unclaimed funds we have. We're still looking for the residents. We take that away from them. We do all of that. Shiva is huge.
And is there a penalty for failure to comply?
There is. As a matter of fact, supposedly this year, the government is really concentrating because they haven't really done a whole lot. There is definitely penalties around that, but we haven't really heard of companies being penalized, but supposedly it's on the docket for this year for them to kind of focus in on achievement. So we've been taking care of that. We talked to operators that have more in escheatment than they do of their current resident security deposit.
So given all this compliance and then all the complexity that's coming in from just operating in multiple jurisdictions, and that would go even further to the movement towards more third party management, this problem is starting to compound itself. And, you know, finance executives are becoming fewer and fewer over and over again, and, you know, managing all this stuff is complicated to get money. So, like, why do people say no?
I know. Yes.
Yeah. So, why do you hear
it? We call it a no-brainer. You call it a hell yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
But you get objections, and why?
We do. So, you know, typically it's not so. I wouldn't even say objections. I think the few, and it's really been a few companies that, or that we've had demos where people kind of just didn't get it. Yeah. Because then they go back and say, like, okay, so you're a security deposit, then how do you do this? And I'm more like, no, we're not a security deposit company. You know, they're talking about the lease locks of the world or guarantors or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But we're like, no, we're not them. We will work alongside if you are working with some of these, but no, that's not what we do. But sometimes even trying to say it, kind of highlight it in a different way, sometimes they just don't get it. They're like, no, we're kind of not looking for that. And I'm like, oh my God, like, you really need this. But that's really far and in between. Most of the time they love it. And they'll say, how can we sign it up? And then, but that part of it is like, you know, I'm pushing for the next call for the next, and typically that can work. But sometimes they're like, no, I need to get my whole committee. You know, companies now are so sophisticated. They have committees on new initiatives and things like that. So sometimes that's just what takes a while. It'll just take a while, especially for bigger companies, right? It takes them a while. They have all these other initiatives that they're rolling out. They're like, oh, this isn't for this year. I probably hear more of that than like, no, this would never work with my company.
Because it's cash contingency or custodianship of cash. There's definitely more than one person making a decision.
Yes. Absolutely. Right. Always. There's more than one person. I just had a demo recently, not a huge company, but a good, you know, 5,000 units. And mind you, the president had been at a different company. And so he already knew about us. So as soon as he got into the new company, the bigger company he worked for, they're very slow. And so we're still kind of, it's been 2 years that we did a demo with quite a few other team members, and then changes have happened. So we're continuing to do demos, but he came into a new role, 5,000 units. And he's like, okay, I have our controller with me. Let's go ahead and do it. So we're going to be launching them really soon,
The 5,000 units, like, if I go at $2,000 or deposits, that's like that $10 million. That's a ton of money.
That's a lot of money. Yeah.
When you think about it, it's 1 month of rent for each one of those buildings. I hope I have my math right. It feels like it's 10 million. Be corrected if I'm wrong. But like that sounds like that's a ton of money from a to be exchanging custodianship. So there's kind of like two sets of keys in that conversation.
Well, and think about this with they may not have as many resources. Bigger companies have a lot of resources at the same time. They're so huge. It's still hard to manage all of that, right? Mm-hmm. Because again, we're going back into compliance and legislation and mm-hmm. all that stuff. So why not have the experts do this part of it? You're centralizing other areas of your companies. This one just, again.
Okay, I would expect... My guess, through this conversation, my guess is that your top of funnel is really fast, high conversion, because of the no-brainerness to it all. But you must have, like, it must go from whatever 100 miles an hour, and then it must just scream to a playground zone as you get to the close to the funnel, because of all the complexities of cash. I can just imagine that being your pipeline.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, it's been educational, I want to say, just in the 3 years that I've been here. And what I mean by that is really educating some in our industry about what we're doing. And this year is just pretty incredible for Deposit Cloud. It's really blowing up. I think it's really getting out there, the reputation. You know, a part of it too, besides like what we do, the core of our company, which I love, we have really good people that have been in the industry for a long, long time. And it's like, we're all very connected. And obviously we don't know everybody, but our friends, the network that we have are the ones that are introducing us to people that they're closer to on the operator side or the owner side. So that has made it's just been super impactful. And, you know, obviously the conferences that we go to as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, I think that there's just less and less people that want to deal with compliance things. And so, and again, like, why would you hire a specialist for the shipment process in Oregon and California and Nevada and Texas when you could just outsource the whole thing and not have to worry about, because like the cost of being wrong is much higher than the benefit of being right.
Absolutely. So you know, and I like how you said a specialist. It's kind of like, I'm just thinking that if you went to the doctors and he says you have a heart problem, you're not going to go to the same doctor. You're going to go to a specialist. That's what we are. We're the specialist for.
Well, tax litigation, you don't have one tax lawyer accounting legislation. You wouldn't have a single lawyer. You're working in five different states. You don't have one person that knows the laws of all five states. And then this is county below that. It's like humanly possible to do a good job at it. So, you know, it's starting to kind of like really frame itself as something that has to be outsourced, right? It's like, it doesn't seem to be a good choice to do it internally.
Yeah, even if you're not working outside of a specific state, which a lot of our clients are, we're working with, you know, some of the top NMHC, top 50 companies, but some of the smaller ones may have that state, but there is a lot. I mean, you have to really keep up with the laws. I have really good friends that, you know, own their own management companies. And this has been a really difficult time for them. Just the last few years with all the legislation, it's like one more thing. Security deposits is only one factor of the many laws that ownership has to deal with.
Yeah, like the metaphor that it kind of pops into mind is payroll at source deductions, right? Like payroll at source deductions, if you're doing that internally, you must have a very straightforward business, because it's complicated, it's jurisdictional, it's other people's money, and the fines are big if you get it wrong, right? And so like you hire a ADT to manage that, or you hire a Ceridian to manage that, because like they understand and they update the jurisdictional laws for all the different jurisdictions you operate within, and they do that for you, and they keep an eye out for you, and they give you a heads up about your rant stuff. And so like that's kind of how it's starting to slot in my head in terms of how this, the parallel to other sort of types of businesses, because yeah, like, and you outsource that. I don't know for certain, but I'm fairly comfortable saying that I'm sure everybody has a payroll processor that's managing all those at source deductions, for them. Otherwise, it's just too much work. It's too being wrong is not worth it.
Yeah. Yep.
When so there are other alternatives out there, and how what are they usually considering when they're you come to a deal, gone through the stages, they are likely to go see other ways of looking at things. What other, and maybe not so much software solutions, but what are the other ways of solving this problem? You have an internal person. Does your accountant do this, or can you have your lawyer do this, or who else does this for you? How else is this job done?
Yeah, they'll either have somebody in that role specifically, right? I mean, that's kind of what operations does, but a lot of times their solution is to increase, lower their security deposit for whatever reason, which is, I know, or they'll look at alternative deposits, right? So they'll look at, again, lease law, guarantors, RINO,
insurance.
So look at something like that. But even with that, there's only a 30% adoption rate on that. So typically it's not really solving it, right? It is, it's another component. You are giving them the choice, but why not give them a choice that's going to also benefit you as the owner, as the operator, and the resident? So giving the resident a choice is always the best idea. What's going to work best for them and make it that it's easy to have entry, yet it's protecting your community, your company.
Well, I think the interesting thing about like insurance versus versus cost management, this is hearing this correctly from today, is that on the insurance side, it's your liability is maxed out at the your exposure is maxed out at the total probability of that the damage or the recovery, right? And then you've got to go through the recovery process, which also takes time, money, and energy. But you also don't get that true up. Like I found it really interesting that you guys do that true up between your forecast of contingency true up with your capital expenditures and the bad debt piece. I don't see how an insurance company can provide that kind of value given the way that they operate. I just don't see it. They could do there could be a mechanism out there where they say, here's what your forecasted capital expenses are and here's what your deposit for those, or say wear and tear expenses are. Here's what your deposit funds look like. But I just don't see how they would operate that way, given that they're underwritten on a probability basis versus cash in the bank.
Yeah. And some, there are certain companies also on that side that they will, if you're really good at sending in filing claims and getting your money, at some point they're not making any money. So they're going to tell you that, by the way, we cannot no longer, we're not going to be paying all these claims, right? So we've heard that before.
Yeah, like they're also, I mean, on the insurance piece, they're in business too. And, what I see from the min fee when we do our insurance negotiation is 40%. And that's like they consistently, call that a fair number. So for every 1,000 you collect, $1,000 you need, there's $400 to go to min on that insurance side of thing. So you have it. There's problems that they solve as well, but ultimately if you're trying to solve the capital true up and the contingency piece, sounds like you guys are cornering that market pretty well.
Yeah, it's exciting times for us for sure.
Super exciting. So you go back and look at yourself. I love your journey as you shared the very beginning. And, if you look back at your journey through life and your career and maybe even people that you brought on and mentored, what bit of advice would you give them as they're starting their journey? Or would you like to have got given yourself as you were starting your journey with respect to finding Hell Yes customers?
I would say get involved with local associations, right? So especially if you're starting off because I was in Orange County, I was very involved with Orange County, San Diego associations. That just kind of built my village, my multifamily village. And you really, you have to remember that reputation also is very crucial. So you want to always make sure that you're there as a consultant, really, even for your clients. We all become friends at some point, right? So there has to be, your reputation has to be good enough that they trust you, that they can come to you. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm a recruiter, because I do get quite a few people from all facets that, you know, maybe are looking for a job. So you really become their friends. You become a confidant, really. You build your network. You continue. I mean, for me, I couldn't wait to be on the national side. So it took me a little while. I just couldn't wait to, like, oh, I want to fly to different places. I want to work in different places. So it became West Coast. What's really awesome about working with Deposit Cloud and Wade, you know, Wade, he's over in Florida. I'm here in the West Coast, but we work so well together. Obviously the whole team does. Stuart is in Kentucky. Where is he? Kentucky.
Central time zone. He's in CT.
Yes, he is. So we have such a good team, but really building those relationships early on is super important. And you can do that by going to conferences. You can do that by getting involved with associations. And that's what I did early on. I was really super involved in helping out some of the associations, just being a member. At some point, like, there's no way that I could do it because I just don't have the time for it, but I will support them in any way that I can. And they're still really good friends. So I would say for somebody that's starting off looking at podcasts like yours, right?
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Seriously, you can learn so much. Like, I was writing notes on some of your podcasts. I love, yeah, just some of the people that you interviewed. Super cool.
Well, people have been incredibly, guests have been incredibly generous, kind of like what's behind the scenes. So it's, the hope was always to kind of like make it to shed transparency both for buyers and sellers. What's interesting is about how many buyers listen to the show. That's part that I find very interesting because, like, we're all putting on a bit of a veil when we do a pitch, but ultimately to dig in and understand the person, the thinking behind it, that may not become transparent in a pitch or in the meetings or when we're all being our corporate self.
Yeah.
But when we're out there sharing why we're thinking about that, how we think about that way, it can create. We've had some feedback where after the show, buyers approached some of our guests and said, I really like how you explain that, and now I understand better what you do and how you do it and why you do it. And so that's been good feedback as well. So again, to your comment, the relationships that you build, that's your word is your bond. That's your leverage factor as you go forward, right? And especially in this industry where you're inclined to work with those people no matter what, it's important that we keep that up. We invest in that, right? Go first. Off, you know, like the bet for neighbor, like off, go first, right? So who should we talk to next?
I really think you should talk to Michael Bowman. Okay. The CEO, he's super fun. Just super smart. He'd be really fun. But also, I think you should also reach out to, like, Keisha Fisher. You should.
Oh, yeah. Keisha FBI? No.
Yeah.
FBI,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Ancillary, yeah. Melissa Bartolucci would be great. She's on the owner side. So you would get the owner side.
All right. Asset
management. She's great. Oh, my gosh. Erica Fidesco, great on the director operations part. She's the director over here in San Diego. There's a lot of great people who helped to tag.
Excellent. Well, I'll tag all three of them. That'd be fantastic.
Please do.
Wonderful. Okay. Best way to get a hold of you?
Thank you.
Oh, best way to get a hold of you?
Gabe@depositcloud.com. GABE@depositcloud.com. So that's the best way. Or on LinkedIn.
You can get a hold of me, exactly. So you'll be able to Parmentalize in a few weeks?
Yes.
All right, so there's that as well. So we take a look at best way to, and if you do leave comments in the live, you're watching this now live, leave comments. We'll catch that later. If you're listening to the podcast, leave comments. We'll do that as well. Hit the like button if you're on Apple or Spotify. That's always helps people find us. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. Thank you, Gabe, so much for your insights. I do agree with you. This is a village industry, and people are definitely helping people up, and especially those that are transitioning right now in their roles. Like, the network is so valuable. So, and you get what you put into it. So thank you very much for all of your help today. Love, appreciate the shares and the conversations. Thank you again. It's been awesome.
Thank you,
everybody.
Bye-bye.
And there we go. Awesome.